This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
It's coming up to 8 minutes after 9 o'clock here in Power Perspective. Thank you very much for staying with us. I am Sibenzile Nkambule. We're together until midnight this evening. In a moment, I have a conversation with the author of the book, The Sex Lives of African Women, Nana Sekyama, who's already joining us on the line, and we'll go to Nana in just a moment. Thanks for all the calls, the voice notes, as well as the tweets from that open line. Just one or two of those tweets that I didn't get to hear. Alan here was confirming what the caller was saying about that road, who says here, Mashudu was talking about from Tembisa or Klerkdorp to Kempton Park is the Zeerfontein Road. I can attest, say, but during the night it was so beautiful, but within a blink of an eye, all the lights were scraped off by thugs. Thanks for that tweet there, Alan. And Vusi, just out of nowhere, I'm not even sure. Why I must read this one, Vusi. Because we are suge. Look, Vusi Oti at 7 Kambule, hashtag Power Perspective. Come Saturday at 6:55, you will lose 3 kilograms. I don't see the DA retaining Tshwane, Johannesburg. Well, these two big metros will be under coalition again. Mashaba will gain 1 seat per metro. And then that's the text accompanying this graphic where Vusi says this FIFA break must end. Kaizer Chiefs fans are gaining weight now. For no reason, Vusi comes and fetches us. Listen, thank you for that. Let me quickly take Maduma as well, and then we move on to my guest. Maduma was on the line there from Hammanskraal. Sbu, I am battling to get the call up. All right, let's sort it out. We'll take the call and then go on to our interview in this hour. 10 off.
Power Perspective with Sibenzile Nkambule. Monday to Thursday, 8 p.m. to midnight on Power 98.7.
Oh, we found the gremlins and we said, quippy, quippy. We got them out of the system. Oh, goodness me. Listen, this happens. But nonetheless, we are here. And we are back. Thanks for your patience. Thank you for your patience. All right, then. I've been talking about this chat, and it's finally happening now. It is my pleasure to welcome Nana Dakoa Sekyama, who's joining us now on the line, the author of The Sex Lives of African Women. Nana, welcome to Power Perspective. Thank you very much for joining us.
Hey, it's so great to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Thank you, and apologies for that delay there. These things happen, as you can imagine.
They do.
Brilliant. Let's jump right in. Nana, congratulations on this book. If one engages a number of reviews on this work, but for you, of course, it's work that you have been doing for quite some time, and perhaps that's a good place for us to start before we go into the process that you undertook to produce this book, The Sex Lives of African Women. You've been speaking about women, women's bodies, sexual experiences through a blog, and now you've put this, of course, into this body of work. Why is it important for you to talk about sex in the way that you do, to talk about African women's experiences in particular?
I think it's super important for us to talk about all of those subjects that we are told that we shouldn't talk about, right? Because that's a way for us to take back control. That's a way for us to take back power. That's a way for us to have ownership over our own lives. So like I mentioned, I have been writing and speaking up about the issue of sex and sexualities for, about 12 years now, primarily through my blog, Ventures from the Bedrooms of African Women, and more recently through my book. And I think it's super important. I think it's super political. if it wasn't important for women to own their bodies, for people to have control over their desires, we wouldn't have governments trying to tell us who to love, who to have relationships with. And I feel like if you don't own your body, what else can you own? If you don't have, you know, if you can't have pleasure in your life and in the very body that homes you, how can you have pleasure in other aspects of life? I think it's super, super, super important.
Were you at any point in your journey of doing this work doubtful or apprehensive at the thought of how this might be received? I mean, there's so much that is similar, and you see this in the book as well, about the various cultures, cultural groups in the various countries. And one common thread as well, I think, that has existed for the longest time is the conservatism that we're often confronted with or we socialized by. The influence of religion, of course, playing a big role in that as well. So were those aspects a factor in this work, and how did you grapple with that?
Well, I mean, before I started the blog, I had moments where I was like, oh my God, how are people going to take it? But to be honest, the reception that I had from African women and girls from across the continent about the work I've been doing around sex and sexuality has reaffirmed to me how important it is to continue doing the work. And so when it came to the time to write the book, I had no hesitation whatsoever. And in speaking to African women from across the continent in the diaspora, many women affirmed to me that they felt that this was a really important project to do. That's why many women willingly, you know, spent time with me, sharing with me about the most intimate aspects of their life, because they actually wanted this work out to be out there, people to know the varied experiences African women have when it comes to sexuality. And, you know, for me, what's really a source of joy is that people are figuring out ways to, in a sense, live outside the box that society tries to put us in, right? And to find ways to navigate pleasure and autonomy over their own bodies.
So let's talk about the process here that you followed. These were interviews conducted over a period of 6 years. You interviewed more than 30 women on the continent, in the global diaspora, women in the Caribbean, living all over the globe, really. Walk us through this journey. When you put out the call inviting these stories, had you a sense of the type of stories that you were likely to receive, actually?
Yes, I have to confess that one of my motivations was just feeling really disheartened by the often negative portrayal of African women's experiences of sex and sexuality in the media, especially Western media, you know, where African women are usually depicted as passive, as, you know, victims of abuse, as victims of female genital mutilation, as women with, you know, who lack access to street towels, for example. And yes, there is definitely truth to all of that. But I knew from having spoken to women, you know, for over a decade about the experiences of sexuality, that there was so much more to our stories. That we were also women with agency, who were exploring, who were figuring things out for ourselves, who were building communities. And I just wanted to show a more nuanced story and a fuller story and a story that I consider more true when it comes to African men, sex and sexuality. And so, you know, I started off with an ambitious personal goal. I thought I would interview at least one woman from every African country. And, you know, after starting the project, I realized how overly ambitious that was. But I just tried to interview as many women as possible. And I did this in a variety of ways. With my job, I travel quite a bit. And so whenever I traveled to a country, I would, you know, literally approach people and say, hey, I'm working on this book. Can I interview you? I did calls on social media. People shared those call-outs with their friends. People introduced me to people that they thought I should interview. And really, that's been my process for working on this book.
the sort of conversations that you would have, again, give us an opportunity to be a fly in those conversations, because there's some delicious stories that you have in this book, but there are also some very harrowing accounts of sexual violence, especially as young women or children, in fact, being violated by men or people who were familiar to them, and how that over time also really they've not been able to shake off, has influenced also what their lives as adult women have since become, for people to share that with the stranger, and that at the time is a relative stranger, that couldn't have been necessarily an easy process.
I think part of what really helped is the fact that I myself have been sharing my own personal experiences of sex and sexuality for a long time. So I think people just sort of trusted me and knew that I would hold their stories in confidence, and I would respect whether they wanted to be anonymous or whether they wanted to use their real name. So there are some women who chose to use their real names in the book. There are some women who chose to be anonymous. And so I feel like the fact I had done this for a while made it easier for people to trust me. It also made it easier for me to ask people intimate questions and sometimes difficult questions, like you said. Yes, you know, part of what for me was really difficult was just this reminder of how many women and girls do get sexually abused at a young age. That is a really difficult reality, you know, but it also speaks to everything that we must do to even teach young girls about their bodies so they have the language to speak about what's happening to their bodies. And for me, it points to the need for comprehensive sex education and for us not to act like ostriches and pretend that we shouldn't talk to children about sex because somehow that will corrupt them. You know, what actually happens, people take advantage of the fact that children don't have language to speak about sex. And you know, I also just sort of created really nice environment for people to be able to open up to me. There are some people, you know, I interviewed in my home. There's some people I had multiple conversations with, you know, so that it wasn't like everything had to be said in one go.
You've packaged the stories in three buckets, if you will, right? You start off where some of the stories are under the theme of self-discovery, and then you move towards to talking about freedom, and then the third element, looking at healing. Again, why those three? And there were some of the stories where I could have, you know, moved from the middle section and put that in the beginning and reorganized it. I found myself doing that. I thought, no, that's not the point of this. Just consume it. Firstly, how did we get to those three themes? Because that for me was quite intriguing. And then obviously separating the stories then into those three.
Yes, no, you're absolutely right when you say that, yes, you know, there's some stories that I'm telling, you know, you might think, if I had made the selection of stories, I might have put this one in, like, you know, self-discovery or even put it in healing. And I think, you know, the reality is, like, we know our lives cut across several issues. Mm-hmm. And so there might be a story that speaks of freedom, but also has elements which speak to healing or the need to heal, right? And there might be a story that speaks to a journey somebody's undergoing, but then part of that involves healing. So yes, there's some stories that could have definitely been like in different categories. And I move stories around quite a bit. But in the long run, I made the choice that I made. And I decided to start the book with self-discovery because for me, it felt like those are the stories that people would most be able to identify with. I feel in this current era, there are lots of women who recognize that we shouldn't just buy into the norms that we've been, you know, brought up with and are questioning and seeking and are trying to figure things out for themselves. And so I felt that a lot of women identify with those stories. And so I wanted people to be able to read the stories where they may more easily find themselves, right? And then there were the stories that I personally found really inspirational, women who I felt were, in a sense, living their best sex life and, you know, show different models of what freedom and liberation could look like. And so those are the stories I placed in the freedom section. And there were some stories, you know, the stories that were frankly a lot more traumatic, a lot more difficult, where I felt like there was still a lot of healing that needed to happen. And in some cases, the woman had gone through like different healing experiences. Mm. And those could also be, in a sense, guides for people who also want to heal. Whether those were women who have decided to practice celibacy as a form of self-love healing, or, you know, gone on a retreat to try and just find themselves. And those are the stories that went in the healing section.
Mm-hmm. My guest this evening is Nana Dakoa Sechema, who is a feminist activist, a writer, and award-winning blogger as well. We're talking about a book titled The Sex Lives of African Women, telling the stories of more than 30 women from the African continent in the global diaspora about their sex lives, about their sexualities, their first experiences, and also their current setup as well. Thoroughly enjoyed this read and also how it's in fact being received. And in a moment, we go into some of those stories as well, and what some of those that stood out. If it is a book that you have already engaged, I'd love for you to, of course, engage us right now on 0861-987-000.
Power Perspective with Sebenzile Ngambule. Call Sebenzile on 0861-987-000.
Still, of course, speaking to my guest this evening, Nana Dakoa Sechema, the author of The Sex Lives of African Women. A fascinating read there. I found myself chuckling loudly or gasping at some of the stories that are here. It's quite something indeed. Nana, perhaps let's get into some of those stories, and of course not revealing too much in the process, of course, on the various stories. If we start off with the story of Elizabeth, who is a 44-year-old heterosexual woman of Nigerian and Scottish heritage, speaks about losing her first love, but also living with a disability as well. Here we go again. All right. We'll try and sort out the lines. Thought this might happen. I know. Oh no. All right, we'll try and sort out the lines because we've lost Nana again. This particular story that I'm speaking of, though, is how Elizabeth, and by the way, the names are not real names. It's not their real names unless they've been identified as their real names, right? So that aspect of anonymity as well, I think also lended itself well to the telling of these stories. And so Elizabeth here is a woman who is of Nigerian and Scottish heritage and is someone who is in a wheelchair. And in this particular tale, she speaks about the struggles of dating and how the people that she sees fetishize, right, her disability, and the sort of questions that she's asked about what she's able to do, and how she's had to learn over time, in fact, to discern between those who, in fact, are using her as a, you know, people who have a list, of things that they've wanted to do, and they've got a checklist. And you know, I've been with a black woman, I've been with somebody with blonde hair, she says in the story, and tick, I've been with a woman in a wheelchair, that she comes across people who do that. Imagine that, right? Where people feign interest or are genuinely interested, but it's motivated by the fact that they are in fact fetishizing the condition that somebody is in fact living in. And I wanted to start with Nana on that particular story about the challenges that somebody such as a 44-year-old woman who identifies as heterosexual and is on a wheelchair, paralyzed from waist down, the sort of experiences that she has in fact had. All right. We'll try again and hope that the tech works with us. And if it doesn't, well, This is what live radio is about, isn't it? It's turning to the top of the hour here on Power Perspective. Oh dear, oh dear. Tanisa Mazwai there with Gwanele. These glitches, I tell you, Gwanele, oh my. It is what it is. I just want to. All right. Maybe third time lucky. Let's see if we can still get Nana on. If not, we're going to have to move on and see how we do here on Power Perspective. Thank you for your patience with us. Thank you for your patience. Nana, I hope you can hear me all right. And thank you for being patient and bearing with us this evening.
No worries. I can hear you loud and clear.
I was leading to getting into one or two of the stories, if time allows also. And I had chosen the story of Elizabeth, who is a woman who is living with a disability, writes about what she's gone through. But if we can perhaps just double click on the aspect of her experiences. And I hope I'm not misgendering as well. But of course you can advise on that, right? But on online dating and how essentially they've met people who fetishize their disability.
Yes. No, Elizabeth, my conversation with Elizabeth was so insightful for me. Because I had never really thought deeply about how the experience of dating is different from a person who has a disability. Elizabeth, in her case, uses a wheelchair, right? Mm-hmm. And I hadn't actually, I guess I just didn't know that also there's some people who fetishize people with disabilities. So there are some people who, and that's the problem with it being a fetish. It's not so much that you love somebody because of who they are or you love them in spite of anything, but that you particularly want to have a sexual experience with them because of that disability. And that's a problem because that's extremely limited. Mm. You know, and like Elizabeth herself would say, and so once you have sex with me, then what happens? Like, it's almost like a tick box exercise. You know, she's like, some people want to have sex with somebody who's black, who uses a wheelchair. You know, it's like tick, 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 not because they care about you or they're interested in you as a human being.
She handled it very well. At least that's the tone of the story here. I didn't get, at least not from this piece, a sense that it's something that has upset her or in fact felt as though there might have been a real connection there when in fact it was just a tick for the other person. Did that come through at all in your conversations?
Sorry, I missed a little bit of what you said. So can you say that again?
I was saying that from her story, I don't get the sense that it's something that has necessarily hurt her per se, or did she not go into that where she may have thought she had made a connection with someone, but instead it was somebody, as you say, just trying to check another box that they've slept with someone who's in a wheelchair.
Right. No, from what I got from my conversation with her is that there's some people who you would realize that are interested in you, but are only interested in you or are somewhat obsessed with you because you have a disability. So she told me about a guy she'd been having a conversation with. And, you know, obviously, if you're meeting someone online, they may not be able to tell that you use a wheelchair, right? And you might choose not to disclose that information for a while because you really want to get the person to know you. And I guess all of us, when we meet people online, we choose which aspects of ourselves to share or not. So there was this particular guy that she was getting to know. He seemed really interested in her sexually. And then the minute he found out she uses a wheelchair, he was like, oh, my God, now I want you even more. Now I have to have you. And there was this sort of desperation. And for her, that was extremely off-putting, which I totally understand.
Let's move on to the next one as well. Another one that stood out for me. And I'll ask you in a moment to perhaps share one, if you can, right, on all of these stories. And I imagine you have varying degrees of attachments to it, or and I'm interested in that aspect as well. But the other story that stood out for me was Estelle's story, who has discovered, in fact, that she is pansexual. believes that her heart is expansive. She has the ability to love as many people as possible, and is, when speaking to you, finds herself at a place where she's ending a 9-year-long relationship. So she's been married to her husband, and is at the point where, because her partner is committed to monogamy for life, the marriage is no longer viable, because she has now discovered this aspect of herself that she is actually a pansexual individual.
Yes. What would you like me to say about Estelle's story?
so for me, just the recognition that, one, this is who I am, and then the choice, right, that I'm going to end this setup and not stay, which is something that the people do, women do. You recognize that this is not ideal, but you stay in it because the prospect of leaving and establishing a new life is daunting, and daunting it is.
It is extremely daunting, you know, and I think it's an act of bravery to decide to step out in faith and to decide to explore a part of yourself that you haven't been able to explore and that you know you can't explore if you stay in a current relationship, you know? And Estelle was always very clear of how much she loved her husband, how much her husband loved her, but she knew that, you know, she wasn't going to be happy if she continued to stay in the relationship. There was nothing wrong with the relationship. They both loved each other. But she knew that, you know, she wanted to, yeah, she knew that she was not a monogamous heterosexual woman. She's a polyamorous pansexual woman. And so she wanted to be able to explore that. And that was something that she just felt that she had to do. And I think it's great if people realize who they are and they have the courage to step out and explore, you know, the aspect of themselves that they have discovered. Because I think we are also raised with particular models of, you know, of being. We are told that some forms of relationship structures are more valid than others. We are told a monogamous relationship between a man and a woman is the way to go. Mm. And so as young people, we may not have had the chance to explore. We may not have had the information, you know, or knowledge to even figure out who we are. And so I think it's beautiful if, you know, later on in life you realize, okay, this is actually who I am, and I want to experience my full self. I think it's beautiful to be able to do that.
Even at the risk of breaking somebody else's heart?
Well, you know, we all have our lives to live, and I don't think it's fair to stay in a relationship with somebody because you do not want to break their heart. Mm. You know, I think also letting people go is an act of love, because they might find other people who will be truly happy with them, and, you know, just as they are.
A couple of themes emerge. I mean, even in Estelle's story, you know, polyamory being an issue that comes up in a couple of these stories. That these women as well also recognize that that they could be bisexual or pansexual, they could be queer, having had lesbian experiences as well when they were younger or even now. Was that surprising to you that it came up as frequently as it did?
It wasn't surprising to me, no. But for me, what was really interesting was when I was sitting back and sort of analyzing the stories, it was really interesting that most of the people that I sleep in the freedom section, most of the people that I felt in the sense were living their best sex life were people who were either queer or polyamorous. Mm. They were people who, in a sense, are living outside of, you know, the normative structures, out of the boxes that society places. And it's not surprising that those are the people who, in a sense, are truly free. Or at least that's how I read them.
I mean, from your sample of stories that you have here, would you say that it's probably a lot more prevalent than what we think it is? So polyamory, and people being queer, that it is in fact a lot more prevalent, and it's a function of whether folks are free enough to express themselves in that way.
I feel like definitely there are lots of people who may not have had the opportunity or confidence to acknowledge that their sexuality is not, you know, the standard in quotes heterosexual identity, right? Because of stigmatization, because of how we're raised. And so I think when people like allow themselves to explore their sexuality, they might find that, okay, they're not on a binary in the same way that they thought they might be. And I think definitely there are more and more people who are interested in exploring other forms of relationship structures because maybe they realize monogamy doesn't work for them, you know. And so I think people are more open to those ideas. And obviously those ideas are also becoming more popular through, like, you know, culture and books and podcasts and the forms of media that we consume. So people are also beginning to recognize that there are multiple ways of being and so are giving themselves a bit more space, I think, to question and to figure out who they truly are.
Which story stood out for you? I was going to end things off with your own story, but I'll leave that to our listeners to get the book and read your own story, and unless that's what you'd like to speak to. But which of the stories, just in the last few minutes that we have together, was the one that stood out for you and why?
I really loved my interviews with the older woman. You know, I think it's because I'm now in my 40s, and so I think also the portrayal of older women, sexuality has always been in a very limited way. We think of older women as women who don't experience desire. You know, we definitely don't think of them as women who are like have an amazing sexual life or, you know, experiencing, even just trying to change things up in the bedroom. And so for me, the two older women I interviewed, I just loved my conversations with them. You know, there was Fatou, an older woman from Senegal who, you know, has been bisexual all her life and has, you know, been polyamorous all her life in a Muslim conservative country. And there was Alexis who fell in love with another woman in her 60s, and they're both in their 70s, and they still have a great active sex life. And as a woman in my 40s, that for me was really, really, like, interesting and fun to hear because it makes me think, yes, you can fall in love in your 60s and in your 70s, and it's going to be great. Whereas I think society tries to tell you if you don't settle down in your 20s, you're going to be left on the shelf. You know, so those are some of my personal favorite stories.
And quickly, Nana, who should pick up the book?
I think everybody should pick up the book. You know, I really hope African women and girls all over the world will connect with it. I think men would learn a lot, especially men who are interested in women and in our lives and in our experiences and what brings us pleasure. I think, you know, trans people will find that their stories are in there as well. And I just hope, like, everybody picks this up. I think anybody who feels like, I want to learn more about pleasure, I want to figure out how to live my best sex life, I want to figure out how to heal, needs to pick the book up.
Notwithstanding the issues that we've had, Nana, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you this evening. And thank you very much for joining us in Power Perspective.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
That's Nana Dako Sechama, who is the author of The Sex Lives of African Women.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.